Welcome to bonus episode number 20 of the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. We are continuing on in our Dubliner series today. I'm here with Dermot. Kelly. You know us already because you're paying for this. So welcome to our sitting room. We've changed up the set a little bit. So if you're watching the video version, you're seeing us in a totally different room. Yeah. So how are you doing today, Dermot?
Not too bad.
All right. Are you excited for our topic today?
Yes, I'm thrilled.
Which is?
The book, the a meeting in the Ivy Room.
Ivy Day in the Committee
Ivy
Room.
Ivy Day in the Committee Room.
That's right.
And it is, went in with low expectations. And my low expectations were exceeded. So, yeah, no, I thought, oh, this is going to be really drab. And it was, you know, I like minutia of, like, the past. I've been made the mistake of reloading an old blog of a favorite of mine called shorpy.com.
Oh, okay.
It's H-O-R-P-Y, and it's photographs that are immaculate condition from America in the early 20th century, some of the 19th century. And it's the most hypnotic thing I've ever seen. And some of it is just mundane. It's just people in their rooms and living their life. Some posed, of course. They had to bring in a camera the size of, you know, a small microwave oven. But the quality of those photographs, I mean, you know, a bit about photography, and they're just
I
superb.
Would say those cameras are probably the size of a small toaster.
Yeah. The plates themselves, the negatives are, you know, you said were quite big. And the amount of detail in them, because you can blow them up, and I just keep scrolling. And it's not a site that has an infinite scroll. It's like the old style, which should be mandated, where you've got pages 1, 2, 3 of 600 or whatever. And I think the last time I went onto Shorpy, I was on there for like a week, just until I hit the original post. And since then, it's been 4 years of new content.
So anyway, Ivy Day in the Committee Room.
That's what Ivy Day in the Committee Room kind of triggers in me. Like, it's just this banal piece of electioneering life against the backdrop of a city. And you see the minute little details in it that you would never have known people did. We can get to that when we talk about it. And just the reality of trying to stay warm in Dublin and having to have a fire. Like, there's no central heating or anything like that. It's like there's some old duffer has to poke a fire.
Mr. O'Connor.
He's a bit of cardboard to poke the coals. But the Emirate there in Dublin must have been rank in the winter. But anyway.
Well, it wasn't the winter. It was a specific day. It took place on Ivy Day.
Yes.
Now, before we get into all that, give just a quick rundown of what happens in the story.
So there's an election going on for, I presume it's the Dublin City Council.
Yes.
Which sounds remarkably similar back then to the way it is today in some respects. Like, you know, people will still complain about the corporation and what have you. And the election is between a nationalist candidate. The conservative has dropped out.
That's right.
So they're trying to do, the nationalist canvassers are, they've come in from canvassing on this really horrible day in October, isn't it? And again, not winter exactly, when it's cold enough, they're already starting to freeze. So it's a rough year. So they're trying to convince people who wouldn't want to vote for the nationalist candidate to vote for him on class grounds, because he's a businessman and he's not going to put up your taxes. So if you're rich, he's also rich. So even though he's not a unionist, he's still going to be more in line with keeping your profits in place.
Yes. And so we should throw some names out. Now, it's a story of a lot of names.
Yes.
So they're easy enough to get tangled up in. But Tierney is the nationalist candidate. He never appears on screen, but he's who our characters are canvassing for.
Yeah.
Hypothetically. Crofton would be the Tory candidate. So he'd be a unionist and a conservative.
Yeah.
And he has dropped out. And we're going to talk a little bit about the electoral politics of Dublin, specifically in the era when this would have taken place. This story is set in October 1902. We know this takes place on specifically October 6th, 1902, because it's Ivy Day. What is Ivy Day?
I have no idea.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, well, you know what? I was tempted to explain it now, but I really want you to give a quick summary of the story, and then we'll go into some of the history that would have led up to it, some important figures. We're going to talk politics today. The central question we're going to answer is, was Joyce a political writer? And the answer is yes. So if you've listened to me talk at all about on that topic, you already know what I think. But I want Dermot to give just a quick rundown of the story, any characters that you remember, any actions that you remember, anything at all.
So there's an old guy. Is it Joe Hines? Is that his name? At the beginning,
he was Joe Hines comes in at the end. Joe Hines reads the poem.
Who's the guy stirring the fire at the beginning?
That's Mr. O'Connor. I believe he's the caretaker.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's at the fire. He's warming it up. Mm-hmm. And one by one, all these fellows drift in. And they've all been out canvassing. And some of them are like, to hell with that. Sure, you know, wasting our time anyway. Come in for a bottle of stout. And they, I'm in my imagination, I imagine there's some kind of table. But it's not quite clear. I'm trying to remember now if there was like a big long table that they're all sitting around, or are they just milling around like a more or less empty room with a couple of...
You think
like,
in a committee room there'd be a table with chairs
around
it.
That's possibly skewing my imagination, like 12 Angry Men kind of situation. Mm-hmm. So they all come in and they're talking shop. A lot of it's about the politics. Somebody, and again, a lot of kind of blend into one another. But one of them, there's a neat trick, I'll get to that, with the stout bottle. So anyway, they're desperate for a drink. They must be desperate for a drink. And so they're complaining that the young lad that they called out to bring the stout hasn't, they ordered 12 bottles. So there's a lot of these guys out canvassing. And where's that kid? It's like, where's that kid with my latte? You know, so where is that kid with our 12 stouts? So eventually this kid does arrive. I won't keep you in suspense. And thankfully, there's 12 bottles. So they have a corkscrew. So this is a little detail I love. This is the kind of thing from Shorpy. These, all these little details you see in the background of these photographs. Like, oh my God, I had no idea. And so they opened the bottle that had a cork in it, not a the modern top that we are all familiar with. So they have to use a corkscrew to pop it out. And the three fellas do that. And they've got their bottles. Two more guys come in and the corkscrew's gone. And, oh, we have to get you a corkscrew. And he says, don't worry about it. And he puts the two bottles down by the fire, I think leaning up against the grill, and the heat pops out the corks. So it's a neat little trick that he's got if you have a fire going.
Yeah, if there are a lot of random jump cuts in this episode, there's a wily black kitten that's destroying the room around us.
Scar, blood spot on my chin, that's him.
Yeah.
So
his name's Nettles and we love him and he's a stinker.
So anyway, they put the bottles next to the fire and the thing pops the cork out, which I think is great. But you got to be patient because then you got to wait for the however couple of minutes it takes for the pressure to pop it. So, yeah, so then they talk a lot of shop. And again, the thing that sticks in my mind is we can get some of these unionist fellows to vote for the nationalist candidate because their love of money will be greater than their loyalty to the crown. They mention King Edward coming to visit Dublin. And regulars will know that we're very fond of Strumpet City. And Peter Ustinov makes an appearance in that as King Edward the Seventh, who visits Dublin. And there's certain English, I'm not a monarchist, but there's certain English monarchs I kind of like. And I like Charles II. And because Sam Neill played him in a movie in like 1989 or something. And he's really great. And Edward the Seventh, I think, because he's sort of got this roly-poly. He's a drinker and a carouser and whatever, you know, he just doesn't seem stuffy. They're talking about the visit that's going to come, but so we looked it up and King Edward came to Ireland unofficially, private visit in 04, but he came on an official visit in 03 and there was a whole hoo-ha about that. Maud Gonne was not too fond of his visit, so I think she hung up like black flags or something.
She hung black petticoats.
Black petticoats.
Undergarments.
Outside her house.
Boudoir items. And they sent the constables, don't you see?
But nothing came of that. They're not going to arrest Maud Gonne for hanging up bloomers. Yeah, anyway, so they know that King Edward's coming and they're kind of taking like a very just moderate approach to it. It's like, look, it's good for the country. It'd be a lot of money in the, like with sports or whatever. A tourist come to Dublin. You know,
yes, that was the with the after the race.
Yeah, they're all very money conscious. Yes. I guess they'd have to be. It's easy to be poo-pooing it, but I remember what the 1980s were like and we were all very money conscious. We weren't money mad, but like you had to be money conscious so you wouldn't be able
and
to
I
buy
would
shoes.
Say that the point of view of this story is pretty middle class. All the stories in Dubliners are.
Yeah.
Like that's not unique to this. But
and they of course
that will be pertinent later.
That gets us to the other candidate they mentioned, which the James Connolly stand in
for spoil it, man.
Well, you asked me to give like a synopsis of it. So
his name would be Colgan.
Colgan, who is like a pseudonym. About as much as I remember. It sort of comes to like an abrupt end, like there's no
There's a turn at the end where Joe Hines does show up. Now Joe Hines is a supporter of Colgan and that makes the other men not like him. And Mr. Henchy seems to think he's a spy from the other camp. We'll get into some of this once I start talking, but they're all united under the aegis of one Irish political giant, the sort of person you'd use the word aegis to describe.
Yeah.
And that would be Charles Stuart Parnell, who's now dead and gone, you know, over 10 years. So you've got men from these different political factions. They're all at least nominally supporting this nationalist candidate. Henchy is a sort of monarchist almost. Like, he kind of likes Edward the VII.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Joe Hines is a labor guy. Mm-hmm. Some of the guys who come in towards the end prefer Crofton, who's the unionist candidate. But they're all united when Joe Hines, little Pinko Lefty, gets up and recites a poem about what?
Is it Parnell and how he was betrayed?
Yes.
About the moral humbug, because, oh dear, did he have an affair? Who cares? Like, you know, which I was talking to yesterday about people who are serious about politics should be hard-headed about it and not get caught up in symbolisms and things that are peripheral to the actual material processes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the Irish at that time allowed themselves to be conned, basically, on his moral humbug.
Yes, but they're all united under Charles Stuart Parnell.
Yeah.
That's the surface read of the story.
But Parnell is also safely dead. Like, he's not, if he was still alive, they might have their differences with him.
It's not that simple. So let's get into it.
Okay.
So now it's my turn.
All right.
Just a few notes on the story itself before we really get into the analysis. Yeah. So again, Richard Tierney, nationalist candidate for the Irish Parliamentary Party. Crofton, his erstwhile opponent, is an Irish Conservative Party candidate. He has dropped out of the race, and his supporters are supporting Tierney as the lesser of two evils against Colgan, who's described as a labor and a working man. So he's an Irish Labor Party candidate. They are all operating under the specter of the now deceased Charles Stuart Parnell. And we'll talk a little bit about who he is, what Ivy Day means, things like that. Parnell, I'm assuming if you've made it this far, you're not only listening to the Ulysses podcast, but you're paying for the supplemental materials. You've probably got a feel for who Charles Stuart Parnell is, and you know what an omnipresence he is in all the works of Joyce. The Joyce family were strong Parnell supporters or Parnellites, particularly Joyce's father, John S. Joyce. It was a great blow to the Joyce family when Parnell died, and prior to that when there's kind of a political coup against him. The legend is that the first bit of writing Joyce ever put down was a poem called Et Tu Healy about Tim Healy, who's an MP that opposed Parnell and was formerly his friend. We have a whole episode about that in the main series, so go find that. There's a famous scene in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man where all the relatives get together at Christmas and fight over the dinner table about Parnell, about Parnell, good or bad. And of course, there's many, many references in Ulysses itself. According to Frank Callinan, who's a scholar whose work we'll reference a lot today, he says this is Joyce's first treatment of Parnell theme and the politics of the Parnell schism that happened after his death in the Irish Parliamentary Party. I hope you're not asleep. I actually end up finding a lot of this interesting. I think I set Dermot up with his low expectations because I've kind of known that Ivy Day is Joyce's favorite Dubliners story. It is a story that if I reread Dubliners, I will read it for the sake of completion, but it's never really struck a chord with me. Mm. I'm glad to hear it did with you, Dermot. Part of my thesis today is that this story is anti-Sorkin-esque. They're familiar with the TV writing of Aaron Sorkin. He wrote a show called The West Wing, which was a very, I think, heroic view of what American politics are like.
Yeah.
It tends to not only be a very heroic view of a political system, but he also developed a technique called the walk and talk, where characters will walk and like deliver exposition rather than just, you know, it's in a stationary manner of talking. So this is not heroic. It's quite cynical.
Yeah.
And everyone's sitting around doing nothing. So,
well, there's a lot of fiddly business that a stage director would be able to do stuff with, like even stuff like moving bottles around. But look,
it's very stagey, honestly, the way it's written. You could see it as a stage play.
I would say, like, in terms of our view of politics, would be more like the comedy show Veep.
Oh, it's so great to be part of your feel good moment.
You're a dirty little prick.
Oh boy, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Oh boy. Don't forget your booster seat.
Oh, shove it up your ass.
Oh, thanks so much.
Hey, that photographer who reads lips, he's not here, is he? No, that's a blessing.
But I wouldn't call this Veep-like either.
But it's certainly kind of quite cynical about the political process. Nobody's an idealist in this. It's very pragmatic. Mm-hmm. And the other thing too about, like, why I dislike Aaron Sorkin is the walk and talk is cheap. Mm. Once you've got your steady cam, just get your actors to walk down a corridor and they talk. And you don't have to really think very much. And it's kind of a cheap heat.
Mm-hmm. It feels dynamic if it's not really.
It's really not. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, oh, everyone's moving. They're all so busy. And aren't they so amazing? No, they're not. In terms of like stagecraft, it's blocking and business. Where are the characters in relation to one another? And what business do they do around that? There's blocking in this scene and there's business in this scene. Even something as peripheral as the bottles, somebody has to fiddle with that. And Joyce has to move these elements around and make sure that everyone's got his bottle. Mm-hmm. And I became really invested in whether or not these characters had the stout. I really wanted them to have a drink.